So without further ado, it is my absolute pleasure to introduce to you all Mayor Michael B. Coleman.
Boy, look at this crowd, I tell you. You know what? I'm fired up. All right. You know, where's Frankie? Right there she is. We are all influenced by those who we spend the most time with. And I spend the most time with my wife, Frankie. And she influences me in many, many ways. But one thing we both agree upon is that it's time for change in America. Yeah. Time for our country to come together. And I'm so pleased and so proud to have, in her own right, a leader, a community activist, a community leader, a public servant, a community servant that will be the next First Lady for our nation. She's smart, she's brilliant, she is just what we need in the White House. You know, I'm often known as I'm known as Frankie's husband, and I'm sure that Barack will be known as Michelle's husband, the next First Lady of the nation, the United States of America, Michelle Obama.
Would happen. That's very cool. It's sort of like fired up. I like that. It is so good to be here. I'm trying to adjust this mic while I'm doing this. You all can hear me though, right? First of all, let me begin first and foremost because I want to make sure that we send our condolences and prayers out to the students and the staff, the administration, the leadership, the family members of Northern Illinois University. Everybody, I'm sure by now, has heard about that tragedy that is in our home state. And Barack has already contacted the president, but our hearts and our prayers and our best wishes go out, that is something that we all fear. And I know you all on a college campus are thinking about these issues every day. What we just need to do is stay prayerful and stay focused and know that education is key. And don't let anything stand in your way. So I wanted to begin with that. I wanted to thank Shannon for that wonderful introduction and for her work and her commitment to this campaign and to the work for Students for Obama right here at Ohio State. I want to thank Shannon again and to our good mayor. Now, he's cute, too. Truthfully, that's what we were talking about as soon as my... The mayor's really cute. Yeah, he is. He's all blushing. Look at him. Well, we are honored to have your support. And to Frankie, she is a political wife after my own heart. Because she's really in charge, isn't she? I want to thank you both for coming out fast and furious on behalf of Barack's candidacy at a time when he didn't have to do it. The important thing for people to understand and know that we know is that we're only here because of folks on the ground who are taking risks and moving beyond their own self-interest to try to make something bigger happen. So, Mayor Coleman, I want to thank you again, Frankie, for all that you're doing. We're going to win Iowa. Ohio. We're going to win Ohio like we won Iowa, is my point. Is what I'm trying to say. Is that the feeling that I feel here in Ohio is just what I felt in Iowa. But it's true. Because the truth of the matter is that we went into that state behind. You know, no one gave us a chance. And it's not just the sound of the states, but it's also the nature of the state. And I think the people, the culture is the same. You know, folks appreciate values, and they do believe in hope and hard work. So I know we can do it here. And critical to the win here is what happens right here in this city. Because the leadership out of this state happens here in so many ways. So that's one of the reasons why we're here and why we're organizing on the ground, because you guys know a good thing when you see it. But when I think about this year, and I think about how things have rolled out in Iowa and New Hampshire and all the other early states, it's been an amazing year, because we weren't supposed to be in this position right now. You know, if you remember when Barack first announced about a year ago, and he was not running for this position for the last 2 years. I mean, we had a conversation in December that led to the fact that we would do this. Took him a while to pull together his staff, and then he announced in February with 16,000 people in Springfield, Illinois, in the bitter cold. And right after that announcement, the race was over, according to so many. You know, there was an inevitable candidate in the race, and the first test was there's no way you can raise the money, right? You remember that? And money was everything. So there was no way he could outraise a political machine that had been building relationships on the ground for years. And then what happened? He raised the money. And he raised it in a way that was different. And it was important that it was different. It was something Barack said he would always do, is that what he knows is that $2,300 and $23 doesn't make a difference if people are voting. So his goal was reaching out to as many regular folks and broadening that base of financial engagement so that people learn that you can have a stake with a $5 contribution. So as a result of folks on the ground all over this country, he raised millions and surpassed the expectations of everyone when it came to money. But then money wasn't important. Remember that? Okay. All right. So but what was important was organization, right? You had to be able to build a political organization, and that was something that they knew Barack couldn't do, not in less than a year. He couldn't build an organization out to outmatch the political might of a Democratic dynasty, right? But then he built it. Went to these early states, and everywhere this campaign has gone, we have built a grassroots movement on the ground, because it's another trend that Barack understands is that you can't just come in and talk to the party leaders. You've got to talk to people, which means you've got to invest in laying a foundation and doing that door-to-door work, knocking on doors and building your volunteer base and going into churches and community centers and reaching out to universities and to students and to never forget that young people count. So as a result of all of that hard work, Barack built an organization that many in the early states was more effective than any organization they had seen in the history of presidential politics. But then organization wasn't important. It was Iowa, right? Remember that? Iowa was everything because Iowa was a caucus. And caucuses were different because you had to get down and you meet with the people and you spend a lot of time and people would have to dissect the candidates and get to know them. So Barack went in and did that. And what do you know? What happens in Iowa? He wins. Wins by a pretty large margin that no one anticipated. But then Iowa wasn't important. Iowa wasn't important because then it was just a caucus and caucuses don't matter. So then it was the national race. This isn't a early state race. This is a national race because Barack was down in the polls by double digits. So this was how you could tell who was going to win was who had the lead at the national level. But as the weeks and months went by after the momentum out of Iowa, that lead started to be reduced until we got into New Hampshire. And what folks said in New Hampshire was very much what they're saying about Ohio. That was going to be another candidate's firewall. There was no way that he would penetrate that because his opponent had been building relationships in that state for years. She was supposed to beat him by double digits. But what happened in New Hampshire? He narrowed that gap and walked away with just a 3-point margin. For us, that was a tremendous victory. And then we get to South Carolina. South Carolina. But then South Carolina wasn't important because he was supposed to win South Carolina. Like, oh, darn, not again. But I don't think anybody anticipated that he would win by such a huge margin. And what happened in South Carolina was indicative of what would happen throughout the rest of the states, as we would see. I mean, Barack won every county in that state except for two. And he didn't just win among African Americans. He won among almost every category within that state. And then we go on to Super Tuesday, which was not supposed to be his night. And he racked up wins that defied the logic of how presidential races are run. I mean, when was the last time we have seen in the history of presidential politics, and I said this earlier, a candidate of any party, of any race or any gender who could win in Utah and Missouri and Louisiana and Maine? And I could go on and on, but Barack has racked up victories in every region, winning over every sector in this country. And what we've learned over this year is that the interesting thing about politics is that, you know, folks set the bar, then you work hard and you reach the bar, sometimes you surpass the bar, and then they move the bar.
Yeah, I understand that.
The bars change. It's like, new rules. And we have seen that in this race, but we've also seen a whole bunch of hope, right? And let me tell you something that I've said before is I am proud of my country. I'm proud because we are all a bit cynical, right? I mean, we go into this thing and we believe that our neighbors aren't feeling the same pains because we've seen some bad choices and outcomes, and we get discouraged. But over this last year, hope is making a comeback because people are believing in their own power and the possibility of making change from the bottom up. This is all about you. This is all you're doing. Because by every measure, this isn't supposed to be happening. And it is happening all over the country. And that's beautiful. So we've got to keep this momentum going. Because we still have a lot of work to do. And what I'd say is that Barack will be the underdog until he is sitting in the Oval Office. That's just the bottom line. And we can't take anything for granted. Not a thing. We want to win big here in this state, and we need you to do it. And we have to do it because we still have a lot of work to do. You see that bar that I talked about, that shifting and moving bar, is still happening for most Americans. That same experience of, you know, you do what you think you're supposed to do. You work hard. You invest. You stay out of trouble, you're sacrificing, and you think that you should be at a certain place because the rules said that if you did all this, that you'd be okay. And then they move the bar. They keep moving the bar. And what happens in a society where people are trying to catch an ever-moving bar is that you have nothing left but frustration. You don't have any energy to do anything else but try to keep up with that bar. So when you're chasing the bar, you don't have time to get to know your neighbors and work together because you're isolated, trying to chase the bar. So no wonder our country is divided and we don't know one another, because who's got time when you're trying to chase a bar? And no wonder we are cynical. It is so easy to be cynical when you feel like you can never get ahead, ever. No matter what you do, how hard you work, you can't get ahead. So it's easy to fall into the disbelief that better is possible. And it's easy to feel mean when you're chasing a bar, because you're mad all the time because the bar keeps moving. Things have gotten harder for folks. And that's the truth. And when I say that, people say, were you taking a swipe at your opponents? And I'm saying, no, I'm really just looking at life. I'm looking at the life that I lived growing up that seems like years ago. And I tell you, I'm not that old. I'm 44. I'm young. But I always talk about the upbringing that I had and how that simple life that I had seemed so far away. Things have gotten harder for regular folks, and I consider myself regular folk because that's how I was raised. I grew up in a solid working class community. That's why I know I can relate to folks in this state, because my upbringing is very much at the heart of what everybody is experiencing. I grew up in a working class family on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. My father was a stationary fire, a city worker all of his life, blue collar shift worker. My mother stayed at home because way back then you could do that. A man like my father could raise a family of four on a single city salary. You remember those times when you could do that? My mother stayed at home because she didn't have to send us to private school, because we went to the public neighborhood school around the corner. Because you could do that back then. Because, see, back in my neighborhood, even though people didn't have a lot of money, the schools were decent. And you could count on teachers teaching, parents engaged. Not every parent could be engaged because some worked, but everybody chipped in. So you knew you would come out of there with some kind of future. And I tell people that because when they look at me, I don't want them to see perhaps the next First Lady of the United States. I want them to see what an investment in public education looks like. Because what we have to remember, and what I want our country to understand, is that I wouldn't be here, and many of us wouldn't be here, if it weren't for those solid neighborhood schools and those good teachers that got us where we are. So that's why education is critical. So there was nothing miraculous about my upbringing. There are no miracles going on here. Maybe the one miracle that I saw was parents who worked hard and sacrificed for me. I saw my father get up every single day, every day, and go to work. Man with a disability, my father would walk out of that house on crutches to go to a job that maybe he didn't love, but it paid the bills. And he never complained, never made excuses, never showed any doubt. Because the truth about my father, which is the truth about most Americans in this country, is that my father didn't want much. He didn't want much. He was happy and proud of the fact that without a college education, he and my mother, that they could work hard enough, reach that bar, and offer us a future that they could only dream of. That was what gave him pride. You imagine a man like my father who sent not one but two of his children to Princeton. See, because you could do that way back then. He wrote that check with pride every semester. And most Americans, that's all they want. They want to know that if they work hard every day, that bar that they'll earn enough to take care of their families. That if they send their kids to a decent neighborhood school, they'll get an education, maybe be able to go to college, but at least be guaranteed a decent future for themselves. They want to know if they get sick, they won't go bankrupt. And they want to know that after a lifetime of hard work and sacrifice, that they can retire with a little respect and dignity. That's all folks want. But we're living in a time with a shifting and moving bar that little nothing of a life that I had is out of reach for most Americans. People are struggling all over the place. You know, because the jobs that my father had, those blue-collar jobs, are drying up all over this country. They don't exist. And if you're lucky enough to have a job, bars move because your salary's not keeping up with the cost of living. Now you need two people working. You have to have two incomes to pay for gas and rent and food and clothes and all the activities you have to send your kids to because the public schools don't offer anything anymore. No Child Left Behind is sucking the life out of our school system. So now you can't count on those neighborhood schools around the corner because you don't know whether your child is getting the real well-rounded education that they're going to need. Teachers don't have the freedom to do what they know that they need to do for these kids because they're teaching to a test. And let me tell you something, if my future were dependent upon my performance on a standardized test, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. But if two-parent households are struggling, what's happening with single parents? Because there are millions of them all around this country, millions of people, mothers, fathers, struggling to chase that bar and wondering why they can't make ends meet and feeling like they're failing because they can't. But there is no way on a single salary that you can pay for rent, that you can come home and do homework and cook a nutritious meal and make sure your kids stay out of trouble and go to parent-teacher conferences when you don't have flexibility, you don't have sick days or time off. So you're struggling. And college. You all know how hard and impossible the dream of college has become. You know, if you're lucky enough to be here, it's usually because you've taken out a lot of loans, have a whole lot of debt. But you also, everyone in this room knows 10 other kids who could be here and who are not because they didn't want to put their family in that kind of financial struggle. So they had to forego their dreams. And what is happening now to young people is that they're coming out of college with so much debt in 4 or 5 years that they have to forego the careers of their dreams. You know, you can't afford to be a teacher, a social worker, a nurse, work in government, because the salary that you'll earn won't cover the cost of the degree that it took to get the job. And young people know this. I mean, Barack and I know this. We are 3 years outside of paying our debt, our educational debt down, at the age of 40-something years old. See, because we went to those good schools. And we didn't have a trust fund. I'm still waiting for Barack's trust fund. Keep looking at him going, what about Cheney, your cousin Cheney? Call him up. Do something. But we did what we thought we were supposed to do. We looked at that bar. And our community said, you know what? Get your education and bring those skills and gifts back to your community. So we left corporate America. And with every job we took, we made less money. My mother laughed too. She didn't think that was very funny. But we were doing what we thought we should do. So where we found ourselves at the age of 40, when we should have been saving for our kids' college, because you have to now when they're two, we hadn't even paid off our own debt. And the only reason we're debt-free now is because Barack wrote 2 best-selling books. It's like he put all his money on red in Vegas. It was luck. It wasn't a financial plan. It's like We were lucky. And it shouldn't have been based on luck because we worked hard. We did what we thought we were supposed to do. But we were in debt. And there are millions of young couples like us who aren't as lucky but are working just as hard. Not being able to save anything because they're still paying off their debt. I could go on and on and on. But I won't. Because we know what's happening. The bar is moving and shifting, whether it's health care or retirement or the environment. The bar is moving and shifting on folks. So things have gotten worse through Republican and Democratic administrations. Over the course of my lifetime, I have seen the challenges that face regular folks get increasingly more frustrating. And what Barack says, and what I think he understands, is that our challenges are not that we're suffering from a deficit of resources, because we're a wealthy nation. We are. And it's not that we're suffering from a deficit of policies and plans. I know folks like to know the details. And Barack has many details, whole books full of plans and policies. But the truth of the matter is that a lot of this stuff is not rocket science. If we take public education, we know just what we need to do to create outstanding public schools, because thousands of them already exist all over this country. We know how much they cost. We know what the curriculum should look like. We know what class sizes should be. We know how much per student we should be investing. We know this stuff. But the truth is that we're where we are now is because those few little schools that are good, they're only available for you if you're lucky. We haven't mustered up the will to make sure that those kind of schools are available for all kids, period. No questions asked. That shouldn't be a bargaining chip. But what Barack says is the reason why we're not there is not just because we haven't had the right person in the White House. It's because there's something wrong with our souls. You know, we've lost focus in this nation. We've lost the understanding that in a democracy, in a culture like ours, we are only as strong as the weakest among us, that we have a mutual obligation to one another in the society, and that in order for things to work for us all, we all have to be ready to compromise and sacrifice. But we're living in a time where our leadership hasn't asked us to compromise or sacrifice anything in a long time. We're a nation at war right now, where the only people who are sacrificing are the soldiers that are over there fighting and dying and their families. And it's not that we wouldn't sacrifice, but our leadership has said, just keep shopping. Don't worry about it. We haven't been asked to pay a tax, collect a can, do nothing. But we would if we were asked. I mean, we're even at a point now where we're bringing these veterans home. They don't have housing, health care, education. We haven't budgeted for that. We wanted to fight a war, but we aren't prepared to make sure that our troops come back whole with the mental health support that they're going to need to transition back in. We haven't done that. See, that's where I'm like, that has nothing to do with plans and policies. That's us. Our souls are broken. And right now we need some inspiration. Inspiration and hope is not words. That's not naive. Everything begins and ends with hope. And the only person in this race who has a chance of getting us where we need to be is Barack Obama. Barack gets it. Barack gets it. And I think he gets it because of his character. Character does matter. How you were raised, how you should lead your life, the choices that you've made over a lifetime define who you will be as a leader. My father always said, you judge the character of an individual not by what they do when the lights are showing, the cameras are on. You measure that character by what people do in the shadows when no one is watching. And this is where Barack is different. See, because Barack has been working in the shadows for a long time. He didn't come to this with any special privilege. Barack didn't have an easy time of it. He's the product of a single-parent household. His mother was 18 years old when she had him. Imagine an 18-year-old white woman raising a black kid in the 60s. Now, you know she was a dreamer. And maybe a little naive, but because of that, sometimes they lived on food stamps. But because of that dreaming, this little girl thought, maybe I can travel the world, study women's issues in places like Indonesia. And as a result, Barack got to travel throughout the world in ways that most Americans don't. I just say, imagine a president of the United States who understands other cultures and traditions and respects them without fear. Imagine a president of the United States who understands global poverty because he's lived in it. Imagine a president of the United States who understands how this nation affects small villages in places like Africa, not because he's received a policy briefing, but because he's got a grandmother who lives in one of those little villages. See, that's who we get with Barack Obama. And we haven't seen that in our lifetime in a leader in a long time. That kind of sensibility, but it doesn't stop there. Barack was also raised by Toot and Gramps, Kansans, Midwestern folks. Ohio, we know what values come out of that kind of household. His grandparents were not dreamers. They were folks that had their feet firmly planted on the ground. They were like my parents. The only difference was race. But our values were the same. What we learned in our household were the things we're trying to teach to our kids. Things like your word is your bond. Honesty matters. That you do what you say you're going to do in life. That you treat other people with respect and decency if you don't know them. And even if you don't agree with them. Because that's how you treat other people. There's nothing more important in this world than your commitment to your family and your community. Imagine a president of the United States who brings those values into the White House. We haven't seen that in a long time. And with those values, armed with that sensibility and those values, Barack entered his life in the shadows, trying to figure out how to make choices that reflected those values. And it started the minute he had a chance to make a choice. When he left college, could have gone to Wall Street, made a ton of money. Instead, he became a community organizer, working in some of the toughest neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago, working with people who had a reason to give up hope because they had been forgotten. Worked for years busing single mothers down to City Hall to fight for safer streets and better jobs and better schools. It's like, imagine a president of the United States who brings that kind of experience to the White House. See, and that's what I don't understand. In our nation, we revere experience like running big Fortune 500 companies, making money, spending years in Washington. But it would seem to me that before anybody could open up their mouth and say they would want to be president, that you would have to show a commitment on the ground to real people before you could even think about doing that. But the truth is, there is no one else in this race who can boast that kind of commitment on the street. No one else. And we haven't seen that in a leader in my lifetime. But it doesn't stop there. Barack's a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. Everybody's a lawyer. Too many lawyers. And we are lawyers because that's the only way you can pay off your debt. And there are many lawyers in this race. Most of them made their millions before they decided to help the people. Not Barack. And it wasn't because he couldn't. Barack was the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. You talk about bar setting. You want to talk about intellectual muscle, just sheer brilliance. Barack, they set the bar. He leaped over it. There is no other candidate in this race who can claim that kind of intellectual achievement. But armed with all of that, Barack could have written his ticket anywhere for any amount of money. What does he do? He decides to become a constitutional law scholar and a civil rights attorney in a small firm in Chicago. Why? Because to whom much is given, much is expected. And Barack knows that he's been blessed. When you've seen your parents and your grandparents sacrificing for you, you know you owe something for that. So Barack knows you don't sell your gifts of advocacy to the highest bidder. You work for the least of these. And that's what Barack was doing in the shadows, working on issues like housing discrimination, employment discrimination. Imagine the president of the United States who brings that kind of approach to the White House. But it doesn't stop there. In the shadows, Barack was building experience as a state legislator. 8 years in Illinois politics. He has more legislative experience than his opponent could ever imagine. Working in the shadows. See, but somehow state politics is different. I don't understand. Wouldn't it be nice to have a president of the United States who understands how federal unfunded mandates feel at the local level? And let me tell you, he wasn't a state senator in any state because his opponents will say, well, Barack's not tested. You know, is he tough enough to handle the Republicans? And my point is, do you know where we live? We live in Chicago, Illinois politics, some of the toughest politics you will see. Barack has seen it all. But in that climate, Barack didn't become a part of that system. He rose above it. He brought his values into it. Because what happens when you don't have to do something, when you don't owe anybody anything, you can try out some stuff. So Barack went into politics saying, let me try something. Let me try telling the truth. Let me try working really hard. Let me try listening to people. Let me try building unity with people from different races and political parties. Let me try that and work really, really hard and see what happens. Well, in Illinois, this is some of what he got done most of the time working in the minority. Real achievements. You want to talk about words versus achievements? Let me tell you what Barack can do. Passed health care for children in our state. Passed an earned income tax credit for working folks. Help pass ethics reform in a state that hadn't seen it in more than 25 years. Worked on racial profiling. Helped mend a broken death penalty system that had sent dozens of innocent men to death row. I could go on. But if you want some idea of who Barack is, what kind of man he is, what kind of choices that he will make, look at what he was doing in the shadows when no one was watching. Because, see, when you work on ethics reform in Illinois, no one likes you. You don't make friends. But the truth is, Barack wasn't there to make friends. He was there to make change. And if we need more evidence of what happens when you don't pick the right leaders, when you don't pick folks with courage and wisdom, we only need to look at the war in Iraq. You know, we're in this war right now because we were afraid. Because of that shifting and moving bar, we were susceptible to division and fear. And we had leadership that manipulated that fear. We were mad. We were mad because the bar was moving and we were afraid and we needed to feel protected. So we had leaders with all their years of Washington experience, all of them. And they looked at all the same information. And they said, yeah, we need to fight this fight. No one else in this race stood up when it was inconvenient and said, wait, the only person who did that was Barack. But what his opponents will say was that, well, he didn't have to take a vote because he wasn't in the U.S. Senate. But let me tell you what they're not telling you. Barack wasn't in the U.S. Senate because he was trying to get to the U.S. Senate. He was in the midst of his own tough seven-way U.S. Senate primary. And it was a race that he wasn't supposed to win. You want to know what they were saying in Illinois? In that untested area of politics, they said he's too young. They said he was too inexperienced. They said that he should wait his turn. They said that he couldn't raise the money. They said that he couldn't build the political organization to outmatch a political family in Illinois that had been running for years. Does this sound familiar? They said he was too black. I kid you not, they said he wasn't black enough. And then when all of that didn't work, they threw in that fear bomb. They said his name. Watch out for his name. I kid you not. They said there's no way that folks in downstate Illinois would vote for a man like Barack Obama. That name. So in the midst of all that negativity, where he wasn't supposed to win, what did Barack do? He stood up and he said, let me try something. Let me try telling people what I think, even if it's hard. Let me tell them that I think this war is wrong, it's going to cost us millions of dollars and thousands of lives. Let me bring in my sensibility living abroad and understanding other cultures. Let me bring in my years of working on the ground with real folks to know that you can't come in and impose order in somebody else's culture. Let me bring my years of politics in to know that you can't fight a war without strong diplomacy. Let me do all that. So we have evidence right here, right now, of what kind of leader he will be, what kind of choices he will make, not just when you're watching him, but what will he do when you're not. So that's why I'm confused, Ohio, about people who are confused about who to vote for. And I know there are undecided people here. What do I do? There are so many choices. There are two choices. The first choice is voting for the people who've been doing the same thing, same folks, same game plan that has gotten us here, chasing that bar and expecting that we're going to get different results. That's one choice. And the other choice is Barack Obama. We can do something amazing. We can. We have already done so many amazing things. But we need you. Barack needs you, not just for the primary, but this is about changing the way we engage in democracy. We've got to shed our fear and our cynicism. We have to let go of that bar and define our own margins of success. And we have to be there to do it. We can't not engage. It would be nice if the process stopped because we were mad, but it doesn't. People are more than happy with you sitting on the sidelines as long as they can win without you. And if you're not there, then when it's time to make those choices, they're going to listen to the folks who were. So we need you. And Barack needs you not just to vote for him and win Ohio, but he's going to need you on day one, on day 12, on day 20, on day 800, in 4 years and 8 years. You cannot go back to your lives as normal. Barack is going to demand that you be different, that we engage differently in society, in our democracy. And if you do that, then you can guarantee that Barack will get up every day working hard for regular folks to narrow that opportunity gap that is growing wider and wider and wider. And trust me, he's ready. This ain't about experience. This is about who can move this country forward. And if that's not enough, the final thing I ask people to do is to dream. Dreaming is everything. Words are important. Hope and inspiration matter because you don't get anywhere without it. Trust me, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for a little hope. I met this little girl in South Carolina 2 days before the primary. She came up to me, 10 years old, after a rally. She's like, I need to tell you something. I said, okay. She said, do you realize that after your husband becomes the next president of the United States, it will be historical? I said, yeah. I said, but what does that mean to you? And this little girl said, it means that I can imagine anything for myself. And she started to cry. She broke down, crying hard. And it broke my heart. See, because the truth of the matter is that, well, this 10-year-old little girl gets it. She understands what's at stake. She knows that the bar has shifted so much that she might not be able to catch up. But she also knows that she is so much better than this nation's limited expectations of her. And that little girl needs a whole lot of hope and dreaming. And I know because I was that little girl. I am not supposed to be here. Black girl raised on the south side of Chicago. There was nothing in my life trajectory that would have me standing here. I wasn't supposed to go to Princeton. They said my test scores were too high. Well, I went, graduated with departmental honors. Wrong. I wasn't supposed to go to Harvard. Somebody told me that that school might be a little too tough for me. Well, I went. I was fine. And I am certainly not supposed to be standing here, perhaps to become the next First Lady of the United States of America. But what I do know is that there are millions of young kids around this country just like me, of all races and genders, political affiliations. Little kids, we don't even give a chance to. We tell them that they can't do something before they even try. And they are so desperately looking for a different ray of hope. They are looking for our words of compassion and possibility. And just imagine if you close your eyes and dream of the day that a man like Barack Obama is standing in front of the Capitol with his hand on the Bible, taking the oath of office to become the next president of the United States. What I ask you to do is just imagine what that image alone, what those words alone will mean to the millions of little kids out there who have been told, no, don't. You're not good enough. Wait your turn. You're not ready. And if we can do that right here in this nation, imagine what we can do around the world, because there are millions of little kids around the world that are looking to us, America. They want to believe in the possibility of this nation. They hope that we get this right. So I ask you, can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do this? All right, we need you. We need you. Let's make this happen.